18 years have changed how we remember 9/11. A new oral history snaps us back to that morning.
The sound was so deafening.
This high-pitched sound. And I didn't know what that was, but it was so eerie, like your fingernails on a chalkboard type of thing.
The loudest sound I'd ever heard.
I'm Carol Hills. Also today, Britain's prime minister takes a page from a first grader.
Boris Johnson seems to think that if he puts his fingers in his ear and shouts la-la loud enough and ignores people, they will go away.
But his political opponents aren't going away. And for Israeli scientists, it's tough to see dying coral reefs.
Looking through the glass of your diving mask, sometimes you cry.
But modern technology is resuscitating nature. Those stories ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. People gathered today at the Pentagon, in a field in Pennsylvania, and at the site of the World Trade Center in New York to remember the nearly 3,000 victims of the September 11th terror attacks.
J. Joseph Ferguson. Amelia V. Fields.
It's a somber, familiar ritual that happens every September 11th. Less than a month after the terror attacks 18 years ago, the U.S. and its allies unleashed fierce airstrikes on Afghanistan. And the phrase global war on terror was born. But nearly a generation after 9/11, it's worth asking, are we safer? Carrie Cordero is a fellow at the Center for New American Security, where she's an expert in intelligence and national security.
In the most recent threat assessment that the Director of National Intelligence provided publicly this year, there is a multitude of threats. There are national security threats that pertain to terrorism that are evolved from the ones that we faced many years ago, but there also are additional threats. And so it's not that the old ones have gone away, but they have been compounded by new ones.
And what has changed in terms of the apparatus and tools to respond to those threats and prevent them from being actual attacks in the U.S.?
Congress acted since 9/11 to create entire bureaucracies to do a better job to protect the country. So that includes the creation of the Director of National Intelligence, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security. What I'm worried about today in the current administration is that the leadership of those organizations has been so unstable under this administration, and leadership matters when it comes to making sure that agencies are doing the job as thoroughly as they can.
Now, I want to go back to the Department of Homeland Security, and just looking at it, do you see the creation of that department 18 years on? Do you give that a sort of thumbs up or thumbs down in terms of the decision to create it?
There's a lot that has changed. And so one of the areas with the Department of Homeland Security that we need to pay attention to is the original mandate it was given, which the majority of its original main authorities it was given pertained to counterterrorism. Over time, the department's priorities have grown. And so they're not just devoted to counterterrorism. They also obviously have significant border and immigration and border security responsibilities, and they've taken on an increased cyber security responsibility. So I think it's definitely worth thinking about how we need to recalibrate and perhaps reshape the Department of Homeland Security so that it can be more effective on those issues.
What's an example of a kind of new type of threat that the administration and the U.S. government in general has to adapt to?
Well, election security is a great example. So we know, we have it documented, and plenty of information has been provided publicly through the special counsel's report and through the information released by the Senate Intelligence Committee so far, and they'll have more reports coming, that there was a pervasive, systematic intelligence operation conducted by the government of Russia to influence our election. We know that threat took place. We know the activity took place. We know that it existed in 2018 midterm elections, and we know that it's a current ongoing issue. And yet, there has not been election security legislation passed by Congress. There is not a whole of government approach led by a White House to focus on that issue. The Director of National Intelligence, the prior Director of National Intelligence, Dan Coats, had announced a election security initiative, and he was forced to resign several days later.
If another 9/11 were to happen tomorrow, what would you be most concerned about in terms of national security?
Well, what I'm most concerned about is that the government and the leadership of the national security apparatus is well positioned to be able to prevent something like that from happening today. And leadership matters. And the fact that we have no Senate confirmed heads of the Director of National Intelligence, the Principal Deputy of National Intelligence. We have an acting head of the National Counterterrorism Center. We have an acting head of the Department of Homeland Security. We have an acting assistant to the President for National Security. All of these leadership positions matter because they press on the bureaucracy to do its job aggressively. And so what I'm concerned about is a leadership vacuum in national security right now.
Carrie Cordero is a fellow at the Center for a New American Security. She also teaches at Georgetown University Law Center. Thanks a lot, Carrie.
Thank you.
Who gets to come to the United States? It's a question the White House is weighing. The Trump administration has already dramatically cut the number of refugees allowed into the U.S. It's now considering cutting back the number even further, even slashing the number to zero. That would mark a huge policy shift that's been in place for decades under both Democratic and Republican administrations. Joining me now is the World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell. Monica, it's a pretty dramatic shift if that happens. I mean, can the president do that?
He can do this. It's his determination to set the cap for the refugee community.
What's interesting is this refugee policy, these quotas for refugees coming in, it's a program that goes back about 40 years. And some of the people who benefit are people who assist Americans in time of war in other countries.
Absolutely. I mean, we're speaking on September 11th. It's interesting to note that President Bush.
And that's George W. Bush.
George W. Bush, after 9/11, didn't attack the refugee program. In fact, it was sustained at 70,000 under Bush, 70,000 people allowed into the United States. The idea was that, for example, in Afghanistan, people who worked with the troops, with the military, have been a part of this system.
What is the current number of refugees being allowed in?
It's currently set at 30,000. That was already, though, an historic low.
Monica, what does this mean for refugees around the world?
This is part of an ongoing push by the Trump administration to essentially block certain people from certain parts of the world from entering the United States, whether they are asylum seekers at the U.S.-Mexico border or refugees. With the current administration, it's already been tough because the numbers have been slashed dramatically. If it gets dropped to zero, that will have families split up around the world as a result of this type of drastic change in U.S. policy.
The World's immigration editor, Monica Campbell, thanks for speaking with us.
You're welcome.
Worldwide, questions about where to resettle and how to care for refugees are tricky. But a group of engineering students at the University of Southern California is tackling it in class. Reporter Deepa Fernandez has our story.
In a brightly lit classroom at USC in Los Angeles, every seat is taken as the professors come in, large coffees in hand.
Hi, guys. Thanks for your patience.
But the welcome is blunt.
It's going to be a very difficult 2 semesters.
Eyes widen as the eager faces digest what will be expected of them.
You're going to be doing a lot of presentations and pitches like you're a startup, but at the end of the day, this is about people who desperately need help on the other side of the world, and we're not playing around. It's for real.
As the professors break down the elements of this very unusual class, a call comes in.
Good morning, everybody. Good morning, Los Angeles.
It's one of the people on the other side of the world, a refugee now in Greece.
My name is Amini Mohammed from Afghanistan.
Mohammed explains how he worked for the U.S. military in Afghanistan and how he had to leave because of threats. The students listen, eyes wide. Some of their jaws have literally dropped open.
I have 3 kids. One small, lovely, tiny daughter.
Listening to refugees is what this course is all about. In fact, these students will soon go to Greece themselves to meet asylum seekers in person in refugee camps. It's all part of a new course at USC's engineering school, the brainchild of this woman.
My name is Burçin Becerik Gerber. I'm a professor at the Civil and Environmental Engineering Department of University of Southern California.
Her area of expertise in engineering is how to make buildings better meet human needs. But when the refugee crisis in Europe began, Bajir Gerber was hit by a big question.
What if people don't have homes?
So she and her colleagues are asking students to help tackle this basic dilemma. And Bezhurk Gerba knew that to do this, her students would need to see the realities facing refugees up close.
You have to be there to build empathy, to be able to be in their shoes, even for a week or 2 weeks.
It's a new way of thinking about engineering and design, putting words like empathy and failure front and center.
How are you? Hi. I haven't seen you in so long.
Two of the most successful students are reuniting after the summer break. Erna Rajapagij and Sienna Applebaum were part of the inaugural class last year. They ended up building a shower, which now sits in the courtyard by a water fountain.
Seeing the shower in the middle of campus like this, it's like this was our life.
It's a portable shower, an idea that came only after they went to Greece to meet with refugees there, and after many other ideas didn't work.
We asked our refugee partners who are resettled in Germany and Spain, is hygiene a really big issue in the camp? And they all confirmed that it was one of the worst things there.
The challenge was how to make a portable shower affordable.
One of our first ideas was a pop-up tent, something with collapsible poles for a frame and a tarp surrounding it.
Picture one of those camping showers, packed small, pretty cheap, brilliant, right? Well, that was their first failure.
All of the women came back to us saying, I do not feel safe showering in that.
In the camps, showers are known as places where sexual assaults take place. Men have sliced right through the tarp material while a woman was showering. But after rethinking the shower's design, Applebaum and Rajapagij landed on a long, slender, blue wooden box.
So we really relied just on the design of these panels to provide almost all of the functionality.
The wood panels join together like puzzle pieces and are held in place by military-strength zip ties. There is no way a knife could slice through, which means their target user, a refugee, woman or girl, would actually use what they built. They're now hoping to find a company in Greece to help manufacture the showers.
I am a refugee. I grew up as a refugee in camps. And when I saw this class, I was like, this is made for me.
Omar Azizi is another alum from the course last year. He brought a first-hand perspective as someone who grew up in refugee camps in Pakistan after his parents escaped the Taliban in Afghanistan. So when he went to Greece with his USC classmates, he knew what life might be like for the refugees.
And I talked to a refugee who was very distressed and was walking around and asking, hey, can I help you? And I spoke in Farsi with him. And he told me that he has an asylum interview and he's very much concerned. If he doesn't do well in that interview, it's over for him. And I told him, do you know there's a legal aid NGO that's main job is to help with case interview? He's like, no.
And that was how he came up with his idea for an app centering all the information a refugee needs but can't access in one place. While a kid who grew up in a Pakistani refugee camp, now studying at an elite US college and designing an app for refugees, might seem like a very Silicon Valley take on the American dream, Azizi is turning down jobs with top engineering firms because he wants to work on helping other refugees.
I feel that I have the moral responsibility to give back, and the humanitarian space and the refugee crisis need refugee leadership.
Azizi wants to be that leader, which is what he told the UN and Greek government representatives recently when he met with them to pitch his app project. And he's on his way to becoming that leader. This year, he's been asked to mentor the current crop of students. For The World, Deepa Fernandes, Los Angeles.
A correction to a story we aired yesterday. The Indian state of Kashmir has been under a communications lockdown for more than a month. This came after Kashmir's right to self-governance was revoked. Yesterday, we said that the internet in Kashmir is back up. We should have said there are sporadic mobile phone and landline connections in some areas. This is The World. I'm Carol Hills. You're with The World. We report on this next topic a lot, but we know that people don't always get it. It's Brexit. When we hear British politicians and judges talking about the parliamentary procedure, eyes glaze over.
Each opinion expresses the view that the advice given by the government to Her Majesty the Queen to prorogue Parliament was unlawful.
Wait, proroguing Parliament is unlawful? Since when? And what exactly is proroguing? It's a technical term for suspending Parliament, of course, and it's what Prime Minister Boris Johnson did. But today, a Scottish court ruled that Johnson's move was against the law. One of the politicians behind today's challenge is Member of Parliament Tommy Shepherd. He's optimistic that next week, the UK's Supreme Court appeal will also go his way.
I'd put it at better than 50-50 that the Supreme Court will uphold today's ruling.
What were you hoping to accomplish with this lawsuit?
I'm talking to you from my constituency in Edinburgh. Really, I ought to be in London in the Westminster Parliament representing my constituents, and I am being prevented from doing so by the Prime Minister Boris Johnson because he is so terrified of criticism and being held to account by the elected Parliament that he has decided, if he can, to try and just suspend it and be done with it. And if he gets his way and Parliament is suspended until the 14th of October, then that means that Boris Johnson will have been Prime Minister for 82 days, and only on four of those 82 days will Parliament have been able to sit and ask him questions. And that is a travesty of democracy. I mean, that would be bad at the best of times, but when the country is in the midst of a political crisis over Brexit that desperately needs resolution, it's almost criminal.
Now, some are saying that the court ruling today in Scotland means Parliament can go back into session immediately. Are you expecting that to happen?
Well, that's our view. Our view in the Scottish National Party is that Parliament now should be immediately recalled. The government seems to be just filibustering and saying, well, let's wait and see what happens at the Supreme Court next week. But the fact of the matter is that until and unless the Supreme Court overturns today's judgment, then the government is acting unlawfully and it has unlawfully suspended the British Parliament. Boris Johnson seems to be, if you forgive me, taking something out of the Donald Trump playbook. He just seems to think that if he puts his fingers in his ear and shouts la-la loud enough and ignores people, they will go away. But what we've seen today is that the law of the land will catch up with him, and we are determined to hold him to account.
How is this whole Brexit argument seen in Scotland compared to the rest of the UK?
Well, Scotland, of course, didn't vote for Brexit. I mean, 3.5 years ago, people here voted by nearly 2/3 to remain in the European Union. And when you consider that most teenage voters and people who live here who were born in other European countries were not allowed to take part in that vote, the strength of feeling behind being European in Scotland is even higher than that. And in the 3 years since, opinion has hardened. The fact that our views are being ignored in that regard has given a lot of added impetus to the arguments for Scotland choosing a different path and becoming politically independent of the rest of the United Kingdom, so that, amongst other things, we would be able to determine our own relationship with the European Union and the rest of the world. And there are now a lot of people here in Scotland who 5 years ago voted to remain in the United Kingdom who are reconsidering that attitude and thinking that actually independence in Scotland might be a better option after all.
Now, the Queen is being dragged into all this. Why does that not sit well with Brits? I mean, she's the head of state. Why shouldn't she set all this straight?
Well, I mean, we have here this creaking set of constitutional arrangements. The Queen is the head of state and has certain roles within that. But, I mean, the fact that the Queen is the person whose signature is in the suspension of Parliament, it sort of hides the fact that that only happened because Boris Johnson and the British government of the day determined to make that happen. And they advised her to make that happen. She doesn't really have much discretion when her first minister comes to her and says, this is what I need you to do. I do understand that the palace must be somewhat frustrated and irritated by the fact that they are being dragged into a very intense political debate here by a Conservative Prime Minister who's determined to break all the rules.
Tommy Shepherd is Member of Parliament with the Scottish National Party. Thanks a lot for speaking with us.
That's a pleasure.
Coral reefs are often called the canary in the coal mine for global warming. Coal miners used to bring caged canaries underground. If toxic gases got in the mine, the canary would get sick or die, warning the miners that there was a problem. Below the ocean's surface today, the underwater canary is struggling. Warmer ocean temperatures and acidification are damaging reefs and turning colorful underwater ecosystems gray. But here's some good news. Industrial designers in Israel are working on a fix. They're using 3D printing. Ezria Tarazi teaches industrial design at Technion Israel Institute of Technology. Ezria, you're a diver and have been witnessing the changes in the coral reefs off the coast of Israel. What have you been seeing and how has it affected you?
I was diving all over the planet and you could see the horrible
consequences of global warming, acidity of the waters, and even tourism. So you could see in places bleached corals, gray areas of collapsed corals. Looking through the glass of your diving mask, sometimes you cry.
Tell us about your team's plans for building artificial reefs. How do you do that with 3D printing?
We started with bioplastic, plastic that made from materials like corn. But very fast we found that we don't want even the idea of plastic, even if it's natural, to be in the water. And the second thing is that the printing time was really, really slow. And when we moved to ceramics, it was much faster and much seems to us natural. So the idea was to print clay with a natural material, but also use a very flexible shape that gives us complexity and variety. So we have like hundreds of components and each one is different.
Have you tested it out underwater to see if it works?
Yeah. Right now in the Red Sea, the port of Eilat, we have installed a one column of like 30 components like this. And already 1 month after installation, we saw a lot of algae coming and covering the reef and a lot of fish.
I was curious to what degree a 3D printed coral reef can replicate what a natural coral reef does for the ecosystem.
This is the thing. We are not trying to imitate nature. We're trying to instigate nature. So upon these constructions, corals will grow and build the reef again.
There's a debate in the scientific community over whether humans should attempt to build artificial reefs at all, whether they're actually interfering with the natural ecosystem. How's your project do on that score?
The classic approach was to sink ships, wrecks, and airplanes, and actually a lot of garbage to the sea. And I think this kind of between naive and, I don't know, criminal idea is not valid anymore. So our approach is to do it in much more simple and humble way, using only natural materials.
Ezri Tarazi is developing coral reefs with a 3D printer. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tarazi's research is based at the Technion Israel Institute of Technology. Check out videos of the reefs being printed and placed in the sea. They're on Instagram. We're at PRI The World. We always remember where we were during historical moments. One American watched 9/11 unfold from the International Space Station.
As we zoomed in with the camera, you could see the big cloud enveloping New York City, and we were watching the second tower come down.
I'm Carol Hills. Coming up, an oral history captures how we remember 9/11 on The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH in Boston, PRI, and PRX. It's been 18 years since the world changed forever on September 11th. With each passing year, our memories fade a little bit more. But hearing voices from that day can bring us right back to the pain, confusion, and chaos of that sunny September morning. Author Garrett Graff's new oral history of 9/11 is called The Only Plane in the Sky. It's a reference to President Bush aboard Air Force One, the only plane still flying after all U.S. commercial aircraft was grounded. The book is a timeline of September 11th, told through brief first-person accounts, many intensely personal, from airline workers, government officials, and first responders. Also, people in New York and Washington who witnessed the tragedy on their way to work.
The sound was so deafening.
This high-pitched sound. And I didn't know what that was, but it was so eerie, like your fingernails on a chalkboard type of thing.
The loudest sound I'd ever heard.
Those are among the painful eyewitness testimonies read by actors in the audio version of the book. Here's another recollection near the start of the book from a ferry captain. His name is Peter Johansson. Just after the first plane struck the World Trade Center, he watched his passengers as they were filing off his ferry at Wall Street.
Honestly, I think most people felt it was a navigation accident. The reason I say that is our ferry continued around to Pier 11, the Wall Street terminal, and there were about 100 people on board. Every single one of them got off and went to work that morning. And as they're walking off, there are envelopes and letters floating down from the sky.
My colleague Marco Werman asked author Garrett Graff what that memory tells us about America at the beginning of the 21st century.
His quote captures to me one of the most amazing aspects of trying to revisit and understand what that day was like for people to experience. And it's just how innocent America truly was that morning. You know, we hear that 9/11 changed everything. We say it sort of flippantly today without really remembering just how different our country was on that Tuesday morning in September 18 years ago. Every one of those commuters got off the boat and walked into their jobs at Lower Manhattan, even as papers and envelopes fluttered down from the impact zone above. And what it captured to me was this idea that so much of America looked at that first crash on 9/11 and assumed it was an accident, assumed it was a problem with the plane, a problem, you know, a pilot having a heart attack, a problem with air traffic control. And of course, this is just almost unimaginable to us today, this innocence. You know, you saw that video last month of the motorcycle backfiring in Times Square and everyone running for their lives. You know, we hear a noise today, something weird happens in a public place, and we default to thinking that it's terrorism, that it's an attack, that it's a shooting, and that that's just really not where America was on 9/11.
Some of the testimonies from people you spoke with really convey also the helplessness of the onlookers. I want us to hear Commander Frank Culbertson. He was an astronaut on the International Space Station, the only American, as you say, not on planet Earth that day. And Culbertson here is describing what he saw appearing out of his spacecraft window on 9/11.
As we zoomed in with the camera, you could see the big cloud enveloping New York City, and we were watching the second tower come down. And traveling 5 miles a second, New York goes across the horizon very quickly, and it was a long 90 minutes to come back around and check out my country again, and it just really hurt.
Mm. I mean, watching from space was probably the only way to get a bigger picture of that day. He even saw Air Force One's contrails heading back to Washington because, as he said, planes were grounded and the sky was clear as a bell. Garrett, we've already had extremely detailed explanations of why and how 9/11 happened. Why did you compile these accounts?
To me, it was trying to recapture the experience of 9/11. I mean, this year, this anniversary, the 18th, sort of marks a moment as the nation shifts from the 9/11 as memory to 9/11 as history. I mean, you have the first college class of students coming in born after 9/11. You have the first American servicemen and women this year being deployed to the war zones of Afghanistan and Iraq and to guard prisoners at Guantanamo Bay who were captured on battlefields before they were even born. And we remember the facts of the day when 9/11 comes around. But the facts of the day are in some ways less important, I think, to our national memory than the experience of the day, because it really was the way that we experienced that day, the way that America lived it coast to coast, morning to night, that drove so much of the decision-making that came after.
Going back to some of the testimonies, Garrett, you sat down with Andy Card, who was chief of staff at the White House for President George W. Bush. Here is Andrew Card reading his recollections for you of how he broke the news to the president, who was visiting a school in Florida that day.
I decided to pass on two facts and an editorial comment. I didn't want to invite a conversation because the president was sitting in front of second grade students in that classroom. The teacher asked the students to take out their books. So I took that opportunity to approach the president. I whispered in his ear, "A second plane hit the second tower. America is under attack." I took a couple of steps back so he couldn't ask me any questions.
Chief of Staff Andrew Card there explaining what happened with him and the president down in Florida when they heard the news. I have to say some of these accounts, Garrett, are really tough to read. It's stuff people may recall from 2001, but perhaps it was stuff that was just so horrifying they had to turn away at the time. You have witnesses who saw some of those people as they went to work in the World Trades, but were incinerated on the spot by fireballs after the first impact of the planes. Others got really severely burned and lived. Did you meet any of them, and where in the world are they, and how are they getting on with their lives?
Well, I tell the story in the book of Will Jimeno, Port Authority police officer, one of only two people who were actually rescued from under the towers. It was him and his sergeant, John McLaughlin, the only two people who survived from underneath the towers that day. And Will Jimeno is very forthright about the challenges that he faces in his life, the long path that he has had back. He says, you know, the day that I beat PTSD will be the day that they lay me in the ground.
Wow.
But, you know, he has this story that he tells about how, yes, he had 220 stories of the World Trade Center fall upon him. But at the same time, it's really about how you respond to the challenge that defines who you are and how you'll live your life.
Wow, that is some kind of perspective. You also sat down with Colonel Mark Tillman, who piloted Air Force One that day. Here's Tillman reading his account from your book.
I went down to the tarmac to see about having the plane refueled. The plane could carry 14 hours of fuel. I wanted a full tank. It turned out we'd happened to park over a hot refueling tank they used for the bombers. This civilian is arguing with our crew. He says the fuel pits are only authorized for use in time of war. An Air Force Master Sergeant, God bless him, overhears this and roars, "We are at war." He whips out his knife and starts cutting open the cover.
That quote from Colonel Tillman sort of comes towards the end of the day. You know, the president was hustled aboard Air Force One in Sarasota. They took off, sort of flew around the southeastern United States and the Gulf of Mexico until they could find a safe place to land and landed at Barksdale Air Force Base. And everyone gets off the plane and they are surrounded by, you know, armored vehicles and men with machine guns and in flak jackets, and sort of realize that in the time that they have been in the air, the nation has gone to war. That they are sort of landing back into a country that is forever changed, and certainly an environment that has been dramatically changed.
Your book includes many more accounts, though, from men than from women. Why do you think that is?
The attacks hit the financial sector in New York, the Twin Towers, and the military centers at the Pentagon, both sort of heavily male industries. And then many of the first responders are male. And it is one of the things that sort of comes through in a lot of the book to me is just how heavily male so much of the story of that day ends up being.
You met the people who gave these accounts for the book some years after 9/11. I'm wondering, with the remove of time, can you start to see the gears starting to shift in their accounts in terms of how innocent they were and years later were not?
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that I really tried to capture as I was going back and telling these stories in their own voices was the story that we tell about 9/11 today is much neater and sort of seems cleaner than it was when we experienced it on 9/11. I mean, we know that the whole attack takes place in just 102 minutes from that first crash to the collapse of the second tower. Mm. And that's not how any of us experienced it on 9/11. I mean, well into the afternoon, we were worried about other hijacked planes in the air. I mean, there were evacuations and potential threats and fears in Chicago. You know, they closed Disney that day. They grounded every plane in the country. And that we worried about follow-on attacks. We worried about sleeper cells. You know, we worried that there were sort of more attacks coming later that day, the next month. And that really we just didn't have a good understanding of what we were experiencing that day. And trying to understand, I think, all that has unfolded since. I mean, even up until this week, you know, you have the Taliban peace talks collapsing, a direct result of the actions that we took after 9/11.
Right.
We're still living in this post 9/11 world shaped by the decisions that policymakers made out of the fear, the trauma, the chaos, and the confusion that they lived on 9/11.
Author Garrett Graff has compiled the first comprehensive oral history of 9/11. It's called The Only Plane in the Sky. Thanks very much for speaking with us today, Garrett.
Thanks for having me.
We're going to close with one more excerpt from the audiobook of The Only Plane in the Sky. This is Beverly Eckert. She's the wife of Sean Rooney, who was working in the South Tower in New York City.
We met when we were only 16 at a high school dance. When he died, we were 50. I remember how I didn't want that day to end, terrible as it was. I didn't want to go to sleep because as long as I was awake, it was still a day that I shared with Sean. He kissed me goodbye before leaving for work. I could still say that was just a little while ago.
The words there of Beverly Eckert. She lost her husband, Sean Rooney, when the South Tower of the World Trade Center fell. Her recollection and others at the top of the segment were read by actors. Those excerpts are courtesy of Simon & Schuster Audio and are used with permission. They're from the new oral history compilation, The Only Plane in the Sky, by Garrett Graff. Freedom of the press is protected by the First Amendment in the U.S. The same can't be said everywhere. A new report by the Committee to Protect Journalists ranks the 10 most censored countries in the world. Courtney Raj is CPJ's advocacy director. She says the three worst countries for censorship are Eritrea, North Korea, and Turkmenistan.
There is virtually no independent media within the country. So the media that do operate in the country are essentially mouthpieces of the state and of the government. If there is independent journalism, it's conducted from exile. And we see that very few foreign journalists are allowed to enter. There is very low internet access. And so it really is a tightly, tightly controlled and restricted information environment.
Did those very facts of tightly controlling information and having no free press make it difficult to do this study?
It does make it very difficult. It's hard to get information out of those countries. But the fact is, in Eritrea, which is the leading jailer of journalists in sub-Saharan Africa, many of those journalists have been in jail so long, we don't actually know if they are even still alive or where they are, and neither do their families. It's a virtual black hole.
You've mentioned Eritrea, North Korea, and Turkmenistan top your list. What are the rest of the countries in the top 10?
Following those three is Saudi Arabia, followed by China, Vietnam, Iran, Equatorial Guinea, Belarus, and Cuba. These countries really are known as being highly censorial. So Vietnam has overseen a massive crackdown on independent journalism, which primarily takes place via blogging. Iran, for example, also tops the list regularly of countries that imprison journalists. Cuba, although it released many journalists who were in prison, continues to engage in a lot of censorship as well as maintaining very low levels of internet access, which restricts the public's access to information.
And I'm curious whether there are aspects of the digital age that make it more difficult for countries to crack down on information.
There are aspects of it, but I think that what we've seen is that the sophistication of the censorship has really increased. Restrictions on internet have kind of expanded from being, say, based on URL blocking to full-scale internet shutdowns. We see a lot more sophisticated surveillance and hacking technology being sold to these countries, typically by either Western or Chinese firms.
Why is it important to publish this list? It's interesting, disturbing, but what do you hope happens by publishing this list?
What I would hope is to see some of the international community use their sway to help improve conditions on the ground in these countries. What we are concerned about is that if no one is actually held responsible for the brutal murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi,
the Saudi journalist who was murdered in the Turkish consulate last year.
Right. That this could send a signal that it is okay and that you will escape international repercussions. So that's why finding justice and achieving justice in this case is so important because of the demonstration effect. We don't want this to become a trend.
Courtney Raj is the advocacy director at the Committee to Protect Journalists. Courtney, thanks a lot.
My pleasure. Thanks so much.
The campaign season in Canada has begun. In one corner, on the left, representing the Liberal Party and seeking a second term, Justin Trudeau.
We've done a lot together these past 4 years, but the truth is, we're just getting started.
And in the other corner, coming from the right, the Conservative Party's Andrew Scheer.
Canadians cannot afford 4 more years of Justin Trudeau.
Now, this election should be easy for Trudeau. Canadians are known for being very polite, and historically, they rarely remove the majority government from power after only one term. And remember, 4 years ago, Trudeau enjoyed almost rock star status, a hip, young, charismatic leader who burst onto the world stage. 2 years ago, Trudeau was on the cover of Rolling Stone magazine with the subheadline, Justin Trudeau, why can't he be our president? Trudeau was even a cartoon character on Showtime.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to continuing our great nation's tradition of mutual cooperation.
Je vous remercie.
Canadians are voting on environmental policies, immigration, and trade, but they're also voting on Trudeau's personality. He's been dogged by ethics scandals and is now in a dead heat with his main challenger. At only 40 years old, Andrew Scheer is running in his first federal campaign, and he's running on a familiar political theme. We can't trust the guy in power.
So this election is coming down to who you trust to put more money in your pockets so that you can get ahead. And a conservative government will live within its means so we can lower taxes, put more money back in the pockets of Canadians so that they can get ahead. It's time for Canadians to get ahead.
Not exactly the most riveting speech, but a polite appeal to stability. The candidates have just 40 days to make their case. That's how long Lent is. How long it takes our skin cells to renew. It's a sprint compared with U.S. elections, and a lot less time to potentially spread disinformation. Facebook has mounted efforts to counteract that, you know, clamp down on fake news. One initiate includes fact-checking partnerships with news organizations across the globe. The collaboration in Canada has been in place for more than a year. Emma Jacobs sat down with the main reporter on Canada's fact-checking team.
I'll show you. Facebook.com.
Louis Baudouin has access to a special part of Facebook most people can't see. The list of stories Canadian users have flagged as false news.
But see here, I can see how many times something was shared in total, how many times they were shared in the past 24 hours.
Baudouin works for the AFP Wire Service, which Facebook pays to do fact-checking in Canada. Using this list of flagged stories and other tools, Baudouin chooses articles and memes to dig into. He employs traditional reporting tools, calling up experts and looking up statistics. And he also relies on internet tools, like ones that help identify when images are being used out of context.
Here, I'll take the screenshot. Uh-huh.
To use reverse image search, for example, to demonstrate that a photo that supposedly shows refugees in Sweden is actually of protesters in Chile.
And boom, I've got like all these websites here that have used an identical image.
Most of the disinformation Baudouin comes across involves politics and also health and science, like climate change or vaccines. He writes up anything he's able to disprove in a post for the AFP Fact Check blog. And people who shared the false item get a notification on Facebook with a link to the post.
Saying, watch out, there's additional reporting on this matter by AFP.
Content that Baudouin marks as false gets shown to Facebook users less, but not taken down. The original posters sometimes write him to say they've changed their article to try and get it unflagged. Those posters are usually Canadian, not international.
I don't know if you're going to ask me about Russian bots.
Okay, about Russia. The Canadian government has shared several generic warnings about risks of foreign interference in advance of Canada's October elections. The Communications Security Establishment and Intelligence Agency declined an interview. But former politician Alan Rock wrote a report on potential problems for the Transatlantic Commission on Election Integrity. He says there are concerns that certain countries might try to influence public opinion.
Russia, of course, has made this a major priority in its foreign policy. So Russia, China, Iran, and perhaps others.
They may not support a specific candidate or create fake articles, but try to amplify divisive issues or extreme messages.
To undermine the way democracy works, to reduce public confidence in it, to encourage controversies among our citizens, to undermine social cohesion.
This is what Russia is alleged to have done during European parliamentary elections earlier this year. The fact-checker Baudouin says he doesn't think he's seeing, say, Russian-created propaganda. In any case, he says the motivation behind what's being shared isn't really his concern.
I do very much just like straight-up debunking, so there has to be an element that is factually inaccurate. If someone's being intellectually dishonest, misleading, whatever, as long as they're factually correct, it's I'm not really supposed to debunk them.
He applies this test to a flagged meme that was put out by a group opposed to Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. It dealt with the controversial topic of Canadians returning from fighting for ISIS.
It's a guy holding an AK-47 and wearing some kind of a black mask, and he's sitting in a comfy-looking chair on the phone.
The caption in that classic meme font has the guy saying, and I'm summarizing a little here, "I can go commit crimes abroad and Trudeau will just let me back in." The accompanying text mocks poetry classes that are in fact one piece of a wider reintegration effort for returning jihadists and their families. So it's not the whole story, but Badwin's verdict, the core of the post is basically true. This passes the fact-check test and won't get flagged.
And it's really hard and messy.
Fenwick McKelvey is an associate professor of communications at Concordia University.
And so I'm so also sympathetic to someone who's doing such important work. And yet at the same time, I'm like, man, that is just such a gigantic problem.
A true false test, he says, doesn't adequately address what are the limits of acceptable speech on Facebook and other social media.
And that, I think, is really where we see the inability of Silicon Valley to actually innovate in terms of real responses to this.
We reached out to Facebook to talk more about the fact-checking project and other internal programs it has in place to counter misinformation. So far, the company hasn't responded. For The World, Emma Jacobs, Montreal.
And one more note from our Canada desk today. People in British Columbia, they're tired of changing their clocks twice a year. 93% of British Columbians surveyed say, let's make daylight savings permanent. More than 200,000 people responded to a government survey and said an extra hour of light in the evening sounds great. They said it would bring health benefits and help their commutes. But for you early morning joggers in Vancouver, if you get your wish, come December, you won't really be able to see where you're going until 9 in the morning. Then there are the kids walking to school in the dark. Tough choices in Canada. From the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston, I'm Carol Hills. See you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, PRI, and PRX.